This B Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K-12 curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable, real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. Want to bring IXL to your school? Learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE. Welcome to the Cyber Traps Podcast. I am Jethro Jones, coming to you from Spokane, Washington. I am the host of the podcast Transformative Principal and author of the book School X, How to Redesign Your School for the People Right in Front of You. I am a former principal at all levels of K-12 education.
Greetings, everyone. I am Frederick Lane, an author, attorney, and educational consultant based in Brooklyn, New York. I'm the author of 10 books, including most recently Cyber Traps for Educators 2.0, Raising Cyber Ethical Kids, and Cyber Traps for Expecting Moms and Dads. Jethro and I have teamed up to bring timely, entertaining, and useful information to teachers, parents, and others about the risks arising from the use and misuse of digital devices.
Over the coming weeks and months, we'll be talking to some of the world's leading experts from the fields of education, parenting, sociology, cyber safety, and today, hacking and all things related to cybersecurity. Join us as we look at what it takes to better navigate our increasingly high-tech world. The Cyber Traps Podcast is a production of the Center for Cyber Ethics, an independent, nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to the study and promotion of cyber ethics as a positive social force through research, curricular development, publishing media, professional training, and public advocacy.
And it's delightful to be able to say that that is officially a true statement.
Yes, it is. It's very exciting.
It is our pleasure to give our thanks to Buoyancy Digital for being the proud inaugural mission partner for the Cyber Traps podcast series, a digital advertising consultancy with an ethos. Buoyancy was founded by Scott Rabinowitz, who has been in digital media since 1997 and has overseen $300 million in youth safety compliant ad buys across all digital platforms. For IAB, Google, and Bing accredited brand and audience safe advertising sales solutions, media buying, and organizational training for media publishers, reach out to Scott Rabinowitz at Scott R. Media on LinkedIn or visit buoyancydigital.com. Greetings, Jethro.
Well, hello, Fred. Who do we have today?
We have the pleasure of having gentlemen from France, I believe our first guest from France, which is very exciting, Philippe Humeau. He graduated in 1999 as IT security engineer from EPIDA in Paris, France. He founded his first company right after school and dedicated it to red team penetration testing and high security hosting, all of which I hope he explains to us. He was also deeply involved in Magento's community creation and animation in France, and is versed into e-commerce, having written 4 books on the topic. After selling his first company, MBS System, his eternal crushes for cybersecurity and entrepreneurship led him to create a new company in 2020. CrowdSec was born, an open source software editor behind the eponymous massively multiplayer firewall, leveraging both IP behavior and reputation to create a community and tackle the mass scale hacking problem. And I will say, Jethro, that this is a perfect guest for this podcast because we've been going at the issues of cybersecurity and hacking for some time now. And I think that this is a really innovative approach, and it's going to be good to hear about it. So, Philippe, welcome to the show.
Hello, Jethro and Frederick. Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure, Philippe. You obviously have a really impressive background in terms of dealing with these issues. But in general, what drew you to the field of cybersecurity with the focus on hacking? How did you get started with this?
Oh, yeah, that was because it was the funniest part in my engineering school. You know, some guys were doing like development software and stuff. Some other were doing AI. multimedia stuff, and I saw security. I was like, wow, what does it cover? It sounds so fun. And I was like, we can do defensive security and we can do offensive security. You're kidding me? And there was not much of a low background by then, you know, in France at least. So we could kind of train ourselves on real target. Let's put it like this. So always ethically, we were not stealing anything, but it was about like, you know, breaching another university, saying hello to the girl that you saw last time in a party and so on. You didn't have the name, but all of a sudden you had her name and more than that.
So real world application absolutely. Is what we're talking
absolutely. About. So it was a lot of fun and a very fascinating topic to me. You know, internet was barely born. During my study, I saw Google rising like as a new alternative to Alta Vista, which was the settled search engine by then. So, you know, it was uncovering a lot of things for me and it was really fun.
Well, I love the approach of something that is actually applicable, you know, that you, it's funny how, you know, guys in college want to meet girls and that's where many ideas come from. And it's evolved from there into what you have now, but let's still take a step back a little bit and talk about hacking overall. We hear about ransomware attacks and other things that people are doing to get into people's systems. And I have a somewhat funny story, but also a very shocking story to me, who's, you know, trying to be secure here in my own home. And last Saturday night, we were eating dinner, and all of a sudden, we heard this really loud music that was definitely not our music playing on our speaker in our house. And what we figured out was that this speaker that is not connected to Wi-Fi, it does have a Bluetooth connection, and the Bluetooth connection is open and somebody just connected to it thinking it was theirs. And they were across the street having a little party and they kept turning it up because they couldn't hear the music very well. And it was max volume in our house. And because we've been doing the show and talking about hacking, I was super paranoid that we were under attack. And really, it was quite a simple solution when I figured it out. But my senses are alerted. But how big of a problem is hacking around the globe for normal people to worry about?
Well, you could consider this on a, you know, economical standpoint. For example, if you think about hacking globally, it's a GDP of a small country, actually not so small country. It would be the GDP of the fourth or fifth biggest country in the world. So there's a heap of money on the table, a huge heap of money. So the crime is now organized, industrialized, affiliated. Everything you see like is the normal web, like people working together, people affiliating, people giving business to one another or reusing some components of others. It's exactly the same thing under the curtain. So the scene, as we call it, has been organizing itself a lot lately. It's controlled massively by mafias or governments or both sometimes. Sometimes it's hard to say where is the limit in between the two. But yeah, so it's professional, definitely. And what you lived through your Bluetooth speaker is an illustration of something really worrying. It's wireless opens a brand new era of anonymity. Because if you want to be untraceable and you want to do something bad, you would just break through the next door Wi-Fi system, which is usually super easy, and there are tons of them all around the world, and you know, pretend that your attack are coming from the next door police station. And then once you've done your maleficent things, you will rip off your disk, hard disk drive apart and send everything into the next by river. And with this air gap, what we call an air gap is like going through the waves, you won't be traceable at all.
There's actually, Philippe, a term that is used for a practice in the United States. I don't know if there's a French equivalent, but it's called war driving. And the basic concept of war driving are people who cruise through neighborhoods looking for open or weak Wi-Fi systems. And then they'll sit outside the house and they'll download whatever pirated content they want or contraband material. And then they just disappear. And the whole thing, by the way, is based on War Games, the dialing app or dialing program that was used in that movie. So it's the same basic concept. But what you're really getting at is this element of untraceability. And potentially, if police are doing an investigation into the content that's been downloaded, they will go to that home and they will look at that home as a potential suspect. This has actually popped up in some of the computer forensics work I do. So it can be a real risk for people if they don't take care of their Wi-Fi system.
Yeah, and I love the work you're doing, guys, because education is key in security. You know, this new generation will live 100% fully in a digital manner. We already do ourselves, you know, we're hyper-connected in every way. But this next generation, they will live through, like from being born to their death, they will know about digital era all the way down. Their life will be digitalized A to Z. So they need to know about it. And, you know, speaking about the war drive is something cool, but I saw once in US, in Las Vegas, in DEF CON, I remember, something amazing. Some guys, they were doing a conference. So it's a security conference, but for people that are a bit high, you know, it's really fun. They have really crazy stuff sometimes. And a group of researchers were like, okay, get out of this ballroom in the Caesar Palace. It's huge. Huh? And come with us on the roof. You're like, you're going to empty like 3,000 seats and go on the roof? Yeah. So all the security guys were like, go like this. And we are on the roof of the Caesar Palace. And like, what are you doing with this rocket, guys? Is it even legal somehow? Do you have like flight authorization from FAA or whomever you have to ask? And they're like, no worries about that. Just look at the monitor. And you're like, you see a big screen, TV screen, and they're like, there's a map of Las Vegas. And the guy fires the stuff. So the rocket blasts off, go into the sky, and release some kind of payload that goes down slowly. And the stuff was mapping in real time all the access point of Las Vegas seen from above. And like, wow, that's next gen war driving, guys. And you know what? The first interested person in the audience was a military.
That is a really cool story. I've been to Vegas a few times. I will say I've never been to the roof of Caesar's Palace.
And I will say I'm afraid to go to DEF CON for fear that I personally would be hacked just for fun. If I did go, I would go with no technology at all.
Talk about lamb amongst the wolves.
You know? Yeah, even no like kidding. This, you can do crazy stuff in security. You look at it like this way. I had my guys, we talked about red team pen tests, and maybe we'll be back to this later on, but it consists in breaching into places with more or less a white card, right? The guy says, you are not allowed to do this, this, and this, but pretty much everything else is allowed. And one day we tried something, it's actually my CTO who did it with a friend of his. They were in a hotel in Ireland, there to validate a platform for security of a platform for poker, right? And so the guy was sitting in and being bored to death in the lobby. And they were like, okay, let's hack the hotel. Like, but without anything, like with nothing, we drop the laptop, we drop the phone, we drop everything, even the watch. You don't have anything on you. And we have to hack the hotel. How would you do it? So they start thinking and they're like, okay, can we use the remote? What remote? The TV remote. Okay, that's allowed. TV remote, like everyone has a TV remote. That's fine. And you know, in the VOD of hotels, you have a search bar where you can input the name of the movie you want to see. And these search bar everywhere are usually powered by web pages behind. And you can inject some code here, like bad code, like it's called SQL injection. And the stuff guide an indigestion cannot digest what you send and basically is granting you superpowers over the system behind. So they quickly found a SQL injection and they remapped all the movies, all the porn movies onto Disney movies, thinking to themselves that nobody's going to go up front to, you know, downstairs and say, oh my God, I couldn't have my porn movie, but I had White Snow instead, you know, and they just did it with a remote.
It is really scary stuff, Philippe. We could tell war stories, as it were, all afternoon about this stuff. And I'm actually deeply disturbed. I'll never look at a hotel TV remote quite the same way. But I think that the question that I have for you is, obviously, you're working on a new project. And I'm really curious to better understand what the relationship is between open source work and cybersecurity and IP addresses. So if you don't mind, kind of walk us through your project and give us a little bit of background on it.
At the core of it is a concept that is the following. Big companies are trying to defend themselves with like heaps of monies. And they fail massively, as we can see. You know, they get compromised, they leak data, and they lose money and all. So it means the solution is not like with a super soldier that would kill an army all by himself. Like, it doesn't work. It just works in Hollywood movies. So in real life, if you want to tackle an army, you have to have a bigger army. That's pretty much it, you know. So hacking is organized like armies are. You know, there are ranks, there are groups, they are specialized and so on. So the way we see it, we have to have a bigger army. And as a matter of fact, there are more good intended people than wrongly intended people. So what we say to everyone is like, let's join hands together and work together, because we will outnumber them and we will outgun them. Because we are more numerous, willing to have an internet safe and steady for the business than to wreak havoc all around the place and steal everyone. So there's only one real vulnerability for hackers. They hate being woken up by FBI at 6 a.m. in the morning, right? Because as we all know, they are not morning people, right? They are night owls. So what they do is they shelter their activities. They hide it behind IPs, behind other IP addresses, not their own, because it would dox them. It would tell the FBI, like, go this way, you will find your hacker. So what they do is they borrow IPs, or they steal one and some, and usually a lot, and they hide their activities. What we are doing here is we are peeling the onion. We are burning those IPs one by one. And trust me, in the end, we are not the one crying.
Let me see if I understand that correctly. What you're experiencing is that you see the bad IP addresses that are coming, and the IP address identifies what device you're using, where you are in the world, and you can track that and figure out where somebody is. So when they use somebody else's, you're cutting that off and saying, this IP address is now bad, and we know that. And it sounds like the most important thing you're doing is sharing and communicating that at large, so that everybody knows, if you see something from this IP address, it is likely nefarious and not a good place to come from.
Yeah, it's at the very beginning, what we do is a behavior engine. So we look in the logs. Logs are journals where the machines are writing down what they do, you know, how they interacted with the people. And in the logs, there is gold. What happened? Pretty much everything speed log nowadays, like planes, cars, your phone, server and services, obviously. So we look at the logs and we identify bad behaviors. Like, if someone is trying to do credit card skimming, or like having very small amount of money to validate credit card numbers that are stolen, or if someone's trying to scan your website or scan your password or things like this. So once we identify this wrong behavior, then we block them. There's plenty of way of blocking them, but let's just assume we block them. And then you're right, we share this IP with everyone across our community, saying, this IP ABCD had a bad behavior. It aggressed your neighbor. So protect yourself against this. You can see it like internet neighborhood watch.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. It seems very simple, like the idea of publishing this. But historically, hackers haven't liked to share, even ethical hackers haven't liked to share information. How are you getting over that hurdle of them sharing what they're learning, what they're finding out, what they're experiencing, when typically that's been something they've kept pretty close to the chest?
Yeah, it's a trade-off here. The thing is, we provide an exceptional, a very, very good first line of defense for free. It's open source, it's free, there's no shenanigans, you can look into the code, there's no backdoor, it doesn't come from anywhere wrong. We are truly serious about what we release, and everyone can see it. You can protect yourself for free. Now, the deal is the following. If you share with us the spottings you have, then we'll share back with you the IPs that are dangerous to you. If you don't share with us, you just use the behavior engine and protect yourself locally, that's fine by us, but you don't get the goodie being the community sightings. So it's up to you to decide whether the community sightings are worth sharing what you see or not. And if you think about it, it's exactly what Waze did, right? They are sharing all together so that everyone is safer on the road.
So for the average consumer, Philippe, how do they go about getting involved in this? What's the logistics of working with you guys?
Well, the average consumer, if you mean by that B2C, like people in the house, they can, if they are a bit tech savvy, they can use it easily in their Windows or Linux environment. what we are doing to address this population, and specifically the one remote working, working from home, right? We are doing a small box that has two ports, two Ethernet ports, and costs something like $25, right? It's something you can buy from AliExpress or something like this. And inside, we embed all the critical things you need to have to protect your privacy home. And it will be for free online. You just have an SD card to flash, and you can check it. And it will protect your home and your home work as you do it. Now, the real market we're targeting are exposed IP, meaning people that are exposing services and servers over the internet directly, which is unlikely to be your case at home because you have a box doing this job for you to protect you, more or less, right? So this is the target we have, this 3.7 billion IPs in the IPv4 space and more IPs in IPv6 that is coming with 5G and all.
So basically, someone can plug that little box in, and that will provide all the blocking that you would need and all that, so that as that community is sharing those things, that'll be updated automatically and people will be able to be protected. So a lot of people aren't broadcasting their IPs at home, but there are some specific ways that they are, because pretty much any smart thing that you have in your home is that you can control from out of your home, you have to broadcast your IP to be able to do that, right? So anybody who can open their garage door as they're coming home or see who's at the door when they're not at home, all those people are potentially vulnerable to something because their IP addresses are exposed at that point, right?
Yes, and there are two ways we can help them as well. The first thing is we're working with telco operators, right? Telecom operators, to integrate the system into the box. So they're delivering your box, a router, and we can integrate with this router. So we are working, it's early days, but we're working with them to do so. So that way you don't have to worry at all. It's just done by design. The other way you can do it, and the other way we are thinking about it, I'm totally acquired to what you just said, like this home automation thing. It's super important. I love it in my home. I have a lot of things like this. And what I find out is like those communities like Home Assistant or GDOM or Domotix or things like this, they are not extremely security focused. Not that they don't care. It's just they are not super savvy in it. So what we are up to is to create plugins for those software directly, so that they consume and use CrowdSec without any burden. They just have to click up, add this plugin, and that's done. This is a no setup thing, like a bit like AdGuard. You're probably familiar with AdGuard, right? It's a thing that avoids you to being tracked everywhere and be spammed with advertisement.
Right, or ad blocker or whatever your plugin of choice is. One of the things, Philippe, that I ran across when I was doing cyber traps for expecting moms and dads is that in the context of smart home devices, so many people were buying things that, for instance, were being made in China. And there was a real issue there in terms of the security of those devices. And I think one of the challenges that we all face, and you're in a good position to address this, is how we make this as easy as possible for the end user. Because one of the real challenges, for instance, with baby monitors and webcams and things like that, is that people don't clean up the default Wi-Fi passwords, which leaves them exposed to whoever's surfing, you know, the net looking for that stuff. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's not even just them. At the very core of the problem, we have an extremely strong country in production. You know, no one can manufacture a camera, a baby, a monitor, whatever, at the price Chinese can. It's impossible, nearly. So maybe some president will come with a solution, but it's not tomorrow. So what we see is like everything is produced there. And they are bad. They are as bad as doing firmware as they are good at doing hardware. So meaning you cannot beat them on hardware, but when it comes to firmware, they just cut paste things. They cut paste code that come from anywhere across, and they are not checking the security at all. I mean, it's not even a concern for them.
Right.
I'm not saying it's made on purpose, but at least it's at very least it's loud. It's loose. It's not good. So the way I see it is, we should all be concerned with what firmware we are running on those platforms. We should be able to update them. We should be able to tweak them. We should be able to have like these plugins to secure ourselves. One of our mission also is, since it's free, those guys can integrate the software inside their camera if they want. It's for free. They don't have to do anything. And they'll be part of a network and protect themselves. So we cannot force them to do so, but we have like partnership and alliances that are working on that, specifically with camera manufacturers, because they are the first line where we could progress a lot on this. But yeah, you have to be concerned with your own security, with your home security, with your family security. And you have to know what it implies when you give a kid some device in their hands, you know, a smart device. That's absolutely necessary for your own security and for his security.
We could do a whole nother show with you, Philippe, just on that one topic, because that is so central to the work that we're doing. Let's talk a little bit more, though, about CrowdSec. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned when we were doing the show prep is the question of whether or not somebody could break this reputation crowdsourced approach to internet security. What exactly do you mean by that, and what do people need to think about?
I'll take again a comparison with Waze, because it's super fun. We have some small villages in France and some smaller highways than in America, right? Even though I've been to Los Angeles and I saw like 16 Waze highways being crowded, but that's another story. So, you know, Waze says to those people that are all coming back from holidays at the same time, you should go through this village because it's shorter than waiting in the queue, right? But those villages, they didn't ask for anything. And they saw like billions of cars passing by and they were super upset. So what they started to do is take a lot of phones, put Waze on it, and just drop them in the village, in a place, so that it shows that everyone is stuck there and that you cannot go through because the mobiles are not moving, right?
That's brilliant. See,
that's brilliant. But that's poisoning of a network, because the guys are sending false information, tricking, luring Waze into thinking that there's a traffic jam where there is none. So it's exactly the same problem we have. We have a crowd around ourselves. Some are okay and really well-intended, and some are not. Maybe 5% of them are wrongly intended, and they want to harm the process. They want to harm the credibility of the information we are delivering. So it narrows down to this problem. How do you treat signals coming to you? Some are right and some are wrong, and you have to filter them. And so you have to find the proper way of saying no. IP ABCD is not bad. It's a person that reports IP ABCD that is bad.
How do you do that then? How do you make that determination that it's the person and not the IP address? And how do you do it in a way that doesn't take thousands of man hours to figure out?
These are known problems. They are narrowed down to three main known problems. How do we do it? Is like we give people that are entering into the network a quarantine time of 6 months. So meaning before 6 months, we would not listen to you, whatever you say, okay? We are considering you. So if you say something that has been also reported by someone else, you will be credited of a bit of trust, right? Up until at some point, you reach trust rank 1, that is the highest you can reach in our network. We trust you because you made consistent, accurate, and timely report all the way down for 6 months in a row, meaning you're trustable. Now, think about the case of a very determined hacker that would like spawn 3,000 machines and start spamming good signals at first, and then after 6 months, turn rogue. Well, we would see that this cohort, this subgroup of IPs that register pretty much in the same times, are the only ones seeing the events that they are reporting, which is very, very strange. So they will probably lose a lot of trust. The next thing we have is we are trust rank 0 ourselves. So we are running a bit of honeypots. Those are machines that says, attack me, attack me, attack me. And when pirates are attacking them, they are reporting, oh, I've been attacked, right? So it's as simple as that. And they are seeing signals as well. So they can validate other signals, other providers of signals, and credit you with trust rank. The next level we have is a whitelist of IPs that you are not at liberty to block whatever happens. Think, for example, Microsoft updates, Akamai core IPs, Googlebot, Google Mail, or whatever. Because you could consider that Googlebot is a bit aggressive, right? It's scanning your website super quickly, but it's its job, and it doesn't have time to spend a year on your website. So that's normal. So you're not at liberty of blocking them. And if you try to do so, will probably consider that you're either wrongly intended or it's a false positive, as simple as it is. But we will never put the IP of Googlebot into a block list. And then last but not least, we have settings, tweaks, you know, like we say, for example, if that many amount of violations happens in less than a minute, say, then it's an alert. But the hacker are learning this, right? So they see that the threshold is something like 7 attempts or 8 attempts. So if it's 8 attempts, for example, they will make it so that they will use more IPs, but are on 7 attempts. So they'd be flying just below the radar, right? So what we do to avoid this is we are learning from the logs we are getting in our data lake, which is quite huge for now already. And we are saying, okay, those IPs are distributing the work that they usually did one by one. They're spreading it on a larger crowd, or they are always passing by 15 minutes across, or they are acting as a cohort. So we know they're working together, so we can preemptively block them.
Philippe, it seems to me, in listening to the way in which you're handling this, that you're really previewing two significant developments in technology, one of which is the growing need for artificial intelligence to handle this type of multivariant situation, where you've got a huge number of inputs and behaviors that you need to balance off of each other. And then the other trend, which is something that Jethro and I have talked about with some other guests, is this growing importance of the concept of social credit, which is essentially the system that you're applying with respect to the ratings. And, you know, I assume with respect to Waze, certainly with Airbnb, Uber, places like that, a lot of your ability to use those services hinges on the feedback that you've been given by various elements of the system. How's that playing out in terms of CrowdSec?
You're 100% right. We are facing the same problem, actually, as they all do somehow. We have to solve it all together. But there's a major important factor here. We're here to cripple massively the hacking activity. This is really our goal, our mission. But I don't mean that we should be right 100% time. Yes, you heard me right. Maybe sometimes the solution will let someone go through, will let an attack, you know, unseen or unnoticed. It's not that we don't want to. It's just by trying to be 100% accurate, you are actually hindering your own effort. Because if you try to be 100% accurate, it's very likely that you will trigger false positive and lower the trust in your solution. So what we say is, like, we are a 99% solution, an extremely robust first free line of defense. We by all means never pretended to be a perfect one. So, but by doing this and by joining hands, we are stronger than any system in the world. We already are 10,000. Meaning we are probably the biggest honeypot network ever, so far we know. And it's and counting. We expect to be 100,000 between December 2021 and July 2022. And size matter here. The largest you are, the best you can accurately pinpoint who is a proper or bad actor.
Yeah, that seems really interesting. And I like the approach that you're taking. And on your third point about, you know, automating and paying attention to how many times a cohort is attacking or whatever, anytime you do that, you will have people who just design their software to attack differently, right? So that is a never-ending battle that you, it seems, have to have a human paying attention to, whereas some of the other things you can automate a lot more. How much does that automation and AI work into that compared to, you know, how much hands-on people looking at it you need to see? And as you get larger, will it become more difficult for people to see things because they can't possibly look at all that data at once as effectively as a computer can?
Yeah, that's why this is a battle we gave up right away. You know, we are not fighting on that ground at all. So everything is automated. And we expect to be 35 to 40 maximum in the company, already because I cannot handle more people than that. I'm not good at that. So we are not going to have human validating signals ever. What we will do, though, is by getting a larger crowd, is having more signals flowing and more things to learn from with AI, but also with through our algorithm. And this is where, if you ever heard of IPs reporting to you, you get kind of a real-time attack map of hacking over the internet. And that's super precious because then you can deduce things. You can block massively instead of blocking totally or accurately or pinpointing headshotting someone. What I mean here is like a good hacker or a good group of hackers, they are owning thousands of IPs, right? And they are very efficient because they are using and leveraging 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 of IPs, right? But if we cripple their capacity down to, I don't know, 10 IPs, or if we slow down their operation so badly because they have to go below the threshold not to be seen, we will massively lower the pressure on the system, allowing SecOps and DevOps to take over the problem, to, you know, to breathe a bit and be able to react properly. And also what we are doing for them is we are eliminating all the background noise. I mean, the background noise is like something, one IP over the internet is scanned 1,000 times per day, literally, okay? Quote me on that one, I checked myself. And that's the minimum, right? You do nothing, your IP is scanned 1,000 times a day. This is background noise. This is not something that is extremely dangerous or nefarious to you. But what we can tell with the size of our network is that this specific signal, we saw it only for you or only for a very few number of people that are specifically banks. This is dangerous. This you should look and pay attention to. And by removing 99% of the noise, we'll allow the SecOps to just focus on what matters.
What I hear you not so much hinting at, but at least alluding to, is that the work that you guys are doing is potentially useful in the international political realm, in the sense that there are definitely nation states who are galvanized to try to use these techniques to take down various targets. For instance, let's just say, oh, a pipeline in the eastern United States that might supply a large amount of gas, or something along those lines. So obviously, I'm not going to ask you to go too deeply into this, but I would assume that in the work that you're doing, the concern about nation state involvement must arise.
It does. And what we see very funnily is that a lot of IPs that are rogue are constantly rogue. They are not just borrowed IPs or temporarily compromised IPs. Some IPs we've seen for 125 days in a row, and not just one IP, all the IP group that is belonging to what we call an autonomous system. So long story short, it's an organization that controls a certain amount of IPs. And those IPs, all of those IPs belong to the same nation state. And it's been rogue for more than 120 days, meaning it's probably constantly rogue, not just on a temporary basis. And this is where we also overestimate our enemy. I mean, most of them, they got very quietly used to the fact that nobody is really hindering their operations. What we're coming up to here is like, this system is automated. And if your IPs are blacklisted, there are good reasons for that. And if you have to change your IPs or your behavior being a nation state and remove a whole group of IPs not being able to use them anymore, well, we slowed meaningfully your operations. And you will have to go out, find new IPs and probably expose yourself more, maybe giving FBI or other authorities opportunities to catch you. So we are stripping, you know, we are putting those guys naked in the street as much as we can. So they don't like it. And it's also helping all the good forces around the internet to defend everyone.
Yeah, this is incredibly fascinating to me. And as we close, I think, could we bring it down to a consumer level? And where should a consumer get started with protecting themselves?
That's a very, very good question. What I do already, first of all, I would recommend people to have a Linux box at home that would filter the traffic. I know you have to dive into it. It's going to take maybe a weekend for you if you don't know about it. There are tons of great resources and tutorials and things already done for you to just filter out your network and not just let everything in and out in a really unorganized fashion. Second thing is I would use, and I do use things like AdGuard or P-hole and stuff like that, that are filtering a lot of noise, meaning advertisement, cookies and stuff. You really have everybody, but in the United States, it's really important that you guys, you know, raise the awareness of what is personal data. In Europe, we are way more sensitive to this. Already, we have a framework for that. But in US, it's terrible. I mean, the majors I've been ripping you off your data and what you do and how you do it and when and where constantly. And it's so so much of a pattern that people don't even realize it anymore. You know, when WhatsApp is saying, accept this to go on, people just click blindly on accept. They don't read the lines, right? It's not WhatsApp specifically. It's every major. So be aware already. Also, there are tools that allow you to decline every cookie automatically, extensions of your browsers. Browser systems. So Chrome and Firefox and Safari, they offer these things to get a bit more privacy, right? What I would put also in this, what could I put? I use also a DNS that is privacy protecting, like OpenDNS or AdGuard DNS, you know, things like the security DNS.
Philippe, have you heard of Cloudflare's 1111 app that is available for iOS? I don't know if it's available on Android because I just use the iOS, but it does Warp and Warp Plus as VPNs. And those are, I think, really useful. I would strongly recommend anybody who is working outside of the home or using a mobile device to make sure that they use a virtual private network, because that can go a long way to enhancing your protection. And the other thing is, for those of you who are using iPhones, the fact that the latest updates of iOS, I think 14.6 forward, gives you the ability to stop other apps from tracking your data from point to point across the internet. So you can at least begin to slow down the accumulation of data. That barn door has been open, as Philippe said, for a long time, but still. There's no question you Europeans are much better at this than we are for a variety of different reasons.
Absolutely. There are other tricks because, you know, you caught me unprepared, Jethro, because it's such a wide topic that there are so many things to advise. So VPN, obviously, totally agreeing. 1111 initiative is great. You should use everyone mobile factor authentication, multi-factor authentication, right? It could be a physical device. It could be your mobile, like Google Authenticator is doing a great job here, really. And that's a pain in somewhere dark for hacker to go around. It's really, really complicated. So make their life complicated, for God's sake. Keep up to date as well. I mean, everything that is asking for an update, say yes, mainly. I mean, there are maybe exceptions, but most of it, say yes, because there are good reasons why editors are pushing updates, because they want you to be secure and they don't want their name to be associated to a great disaster, Waterloo of internet, right? Also, something that I figured out that is like really a way in your house, disable systematically anything that is doing WPS, you know, those quick association when you click on a button and your Wi-Fi is open and the device is connecting to this Wi-Fi. Those are riddled with security holes, right? It's terrible. It's the worst thing ever. That's why also Apple is not allowing you to do this. So disable all of this, because you know, with this allowed and activated, you can really get the password of your network, of your neighbor's network right away. I don't mean like connecting to the network. I mean, on top of that, getting the password for the Wi-Fi. So that's terrible, because then you can reuse it anywhere. And some people are using really good password, but are betrayed by simply this, you know, by this crack. It's called crack Wi-Fi problem. So, and also obviously first line of defense, have decent, good passwords. And it's really easy. I'm going to give you today a tip that is super easy to remember. Have like three grades of password. The one you don't care about, right? That your garbage can. So if you do tuning on your car and you don't care about the forum being hacked or whatever, put this one and use it. I don't know. Take something you like. Maybe you're a drummer. Say you're a musician. So you take music underscore tuning. So you will always remember that the website password is music underscore tuning, because it's a tuning website and you like music. And then for more private thing, like your email, your things like this that do matter, what you do is like you take also a music thing, I don't know, maybe Mozart, right? And underscore underscore, or you know, whatever complex character you want to put in between, ampersand and things like this. And you use something else, like, I don't know, saxophone or... Gmail is my mail or something like this. You put words you like and you put in between some complicated characters. And then when you take extremely serious things like your bank account, your cryptocurrency, private keys to whatever is your realm, use phrases, long phrases, right? it doesn't have even to include like specific characters. The fact that it's long is already extremely painful to break. So it's super easy, and you can have like Mozart, Beethoven, classical. You will never forget that one. And then for each and every website or app you're consulting, just go with your base password and put something like ampersand or dash dash or underscore underscore and the name of the website. It's extremely robust already. Okay, it's known. Everybody knows that it would be something dash dash Amazon. Yeah, but you don't know the first part. And the global thing is maybe 20 characters. So it's impossible to break, but it's impossible to forget as well.
Yeah, that's great advice. And making it in a way that a lot of people have suggested, password managers and auto-generating passwords that nobody will ever be able to guess. And what you provided is something that people can actually remember and pay attention to, so that it's it's difficult to get in, but it's also memorable, so that they have a better chance of actually remembering it. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it's something I've been using in my security trainings for companies I've been working with, and they adopted it, most of them. And I mean, they're happy with it because you have a different password for pretty much everything. You will remember them, all of them. And what we get usually when the people are doing decent job on the server side, if ever they are breached, people get what we call hash, right? So meaning they have to be decoded. And the weakness here is if your password is part of a dictionary, it's dead. Forget about it. Numbers, dictionary words and stuff, they will not hold 1 minute, right? And I mean, not 1 second. But if you do this with like extended character sets and a larger number of characters, it's nearly unbreakable. So it's super easy to remember. It's unique per application you have. It could be different per realm, like private realm or professional one or so whatever. So it's very modular, you know.
Yeah, I know, it's been kind of a day. I really, really enjoyed digging into this cybersecurity stuff with you, Philippe. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and to help us better understand what's going on out there.
My pleasure, entirely. I mean, it's the dedication of my life. I love it, you know, helping people out in security. And I do think that all together we can tackle this problem and make internet a safer place again.
Well, that's an excellent goal, and it is one to which Jethro and I are dedicated. So that wraps up this episode of the Cybertraps podcast. In the coming weeks, we will continue our coverage of emerging trends in a variety of areas, including digital misconduct, cyber safety, cybersecurity, privacy, and the challenges of high-tech parenting. Down the road, we may even explore the difference between IPv4 and IPv6. Along the way, we'll talk to our growing collection of now truly international experts who are helping us to understand the risks and the rewards of digital technology.
You can find the Cybertraps podcast on all your favorite podcast services. We hope that you'll share the show with your friends and colleagues and reach out to us if you have topic suggestions or questions or feedback.
Do you want to save time on prep work, increase student achievement for all of your students, reliably meet Tier 1 standards? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/B to learn how IXL's research-proven teaching and learning platform can help you achieve these goals. That's IXL.com/BE.